Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Let's find a conversation between your soul. Let's find a conversation between your soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today, Charlotte E. Rosen. Charlotte is a historian and writer based in Chicago, and she's also the author for Protean Magazine of the recent essay, The End of Resistance History, which is what we've invited her to talk about. So Charlotte, first of all, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Here's the first question. What is resistance history? How would you define it? It's a term that I believe first emerged as a slur on Twitter and then kind of permeated the historical profession. But even beyond the historical profession, historians have become public figures in a way that they hadn't been in a while since Trump came down that escalator in 2015. And I think a lot of people have picked up this notion of resistance history. But as some known resistance historians have said, if you call them that, they will, quote, cut you, I believe is the exact phrase. But what is resistance history? And maybe you could give a little bit of a genealogy of it. And Derek has something he wants to say.
If I could just jump, kind of piggyback on that, I would like you to answer the question, resistance history, great history or the greatest history?
Yeah, great starting questions we have here. Yeah, so maybe I'll decline the last one, but but anyway, yeah. So I think the way that I think about resistance history is, in some ways, it is sort of just like a rehashing of what is a sort of like dominant mainstream form of liberal historiography that has always existed in the US historical profession. So I don't want to say that it's somehow like completely new or unique, but I think that what distinguishes it perhaps is that it sort of has been elevated both because of the sort of the unique threat and visibility of Trump's authoritarian politics, right, has sort of given like the sort of liberal narrative of actually liberal democracy stands for equality or progress, right? Like it's given that kind of mythology a greater platform. And I think just as importantly, it sort of emerged at the same time that, you know, we had social media platforms like, you know, now X, but Twitter at the time, that really allowed what might have sort of just existed in like the New York Times or even the New Yorker, sort of like more rarefied spaces, kind of allowed it to be more publicly accessible and kind of generated sort of like its own hype around this variant of history. And I would say, like, just to kind of like build out some ways of thinking about what resistance history is I think it is essentially, a form of like court history. It's a form of that valorizes or presumes the virtuousness, I guess, of kind of liberal democracy, of, the U.S. as a kind of project, as a political project, and that, you know, all of the sort of ills, right, that continue to plague the U.S., whether that's like, I don't know, racism, and, you know, just an enduring inequality, right, broadly conceived, that is the product of, like reactionary white supremacist political actors who do not represent that tradition, who are external to it, who are trying to corrupt it. And therefore, the sort of like answer, right, is to just simply extract them or remove them from power, if that makes sense. So, yeah, I'll leave it at that. But we'll keep talking more.
So I want to talk a little bit about the origins of this movement, because they start out as sort of anti-court historians in a way, or, you know, anti-courtesans, in the sense that these initial forays onto social media and kind of this public facing stuff are done to counter the like egregious rewriting of history by Donald Trump or the Trump administration the first time around, which, you know, as I think we can say now, like what Donald Trump typically does is he takes things that other presidents have done regularly in the past and does them to excess. Like all presidents do a little bit of mythologizing or myth making, mostly usually about themselves, not necessarily about the whole sweep of American history. These guys just put that on, you know, performance enhancing drugs and went crazy rewriting American history. And so how does this begin to develop in the days of the Trump administration as sort of pushback against the rewriting of American history? And how does that transform then into kind of rewriting it from the other direction to privilege liberal democracy and kind of create or sustain the myth that like every deviation from what we would consider good liberalism has been outside the system and not a product of it?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think I feel a little bit, I sort of want to be gentle, at least with some of the sort of initial attempts, right, to kind of refute publicly some of the more egregious claims coming from Trump and his various, you know, acolytes, right, that were just like willfully, right, and so like flagrantly misrepresenting history. The most famous one probably is like Kevin Cruz taking down Dinesh D'Souza, who's trying to like say, you know, like just say a bunch of falsehoods about the Democratic Party's realignment in the 60s. But there are other, you know, like numerous examples. And I sort of like, I think there is, I wouldn't say that it is as impactful as maybe they think it is. Like to me, it's not, it's not a replacement for organizing. It's not really like building political power in any way, but it's not nothing, I guess, right? Or it's like, you know, it's not nothing to sort of visibly fact check and break down and refute these like just not just like completely illegitimate and absurd and false claims, but like really dangerous claims, right? That are sort of like trying to remake this narrative to be amenable to like claims that the Confederacy was actually good in some way or something like that, right? So anyway, so all this to say is I think the kind of initial foray into like the public sphere by some of these historians was at minimum like, I guess at minimum sort of like net neutral, if not positive. But I think where the problem occurred, right, was in the transition to the Biden era, right? Like if one is interested in pointing out certainly like mythologies, right? Like mythologies that don't line up with the actual material reality of how history has unfolded or the true nature of sort of like American governance, right? Then that would require also an interrogation of like the many ways that the Biden administration, just to give one example, I mean, Gaza is a big one, but we can also even just think about like immigration, right? So Biden and the sort of broader Democratic Party project sort of promulgates this vision of being welcoming to immigrants and like supportive of like progressive immigration policy. Meanwhile, right, like Biden has continued family separations. He's militarized the border even more so. So many of these same resistance historians were completely silent on many of these sort of like contradictions and completely unwilling to also think about how, like to kind of bring in another way of thinking about this, also are like uninterested in thinking about how even Trump's, right, like kind of vicious anti-migrant politics has roots in, you know, liberal policymaking, right? Like Clinton, Obama, et cetera. Trump is sort of building on and expanding and perhaps like pulling back the curtain on those very same politics. Yeah.
One thing I do want to talk about is what is the theory of what they were doing? Because I think this was misunderstood as political action, and it wasn't political action. I actually think, and this was, I'd love to hear you talk about this. To me, this was a form of class politics. It's basically the most elite historians in the country defending themselves. And I actually think it makes sense in light of their total failure to defend against the collapse of the job market. There's actually a connection there, which I wanted to talk about. Wait. So what is the theory of what they're doing here? And then could you maybe think about this because I'm asking about as a form of elite class politics on the behalf of the liberal resistance historians.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that is also where I had a lot of frustrations with these types of figures, where even if one could say, okay, it's not like an inherently bad thing to be, publicly refuting these ridiculous and dangerous claims. I think, but what is problematic, right, is the sense that this type of liberal punditry will save us or something, right? And it feels like sort of at a basic level, like a misunderstanding of how power works, but also a kind of, as you're maybe pointing out, Dan, like a sort of like total disinterest in like the actual work of building like left political power. Like to them, it's just simply good enough to say like, oh, this person is wrong and a hack, but it doesn't actually, it's not actually interested in interrogating or tearing down any of the institutions that empower these types of figures, because I think one could argue many of those same institutions or funding streams or kind of like centralizing ideologies also prop up their own their own status or their own positions. So it is a sort of like, so I think in some ways it's like, even as it purports to be a kind of anti-fascist politics, at the end of the day, there's very little interest in interrogating like the actual institutions in which they're embedded, that one could argue, as many historians and scholars have given rise to, or at the very least are compatible with a kind of like fascistic politics in the U.S., if that makes sense. I read Richardson that way as well, like sort of this kind of, at the end of the day, these people, they think these institutions are good. I think like they at the very least see them as benefiting them and their community, which I think they consider to be like certainly other academics, but I think more broadly a kind of like liberal to centrist middle to upper class kind of like elite, essentially.
How are they so ignorant of basic facts of the literature? I mean, it's at this point, it's just like not, people know what the United States did during the Cold War, both at home and abroad. Richardson is, I believe, a 19th century historian, so perhaps one could forgive her. But a lot of the other resistance historians were 20th century historians. I believe Kevin Cruz is a 20th century historian. Do you identify Kathleen Ballou as a resistance historian as well? She is also a 20th century historian. And these people know quite well, these scholars know quite well what what the U.S. did during the Cold War. So how do you explain that tension? I mean, Kevin Cruz and Kathleen Ballou are very well aware of the racism, the imperialism of what happened in the United States, often at the behest of supposedly liberal governments in the second half of the 20th century. So what do you think is going on there in that tension?
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to be clear that like I do think that it's like aspects of like there are many scholars who sort of, I think, like participate in resistance history sort of discourse that I think do really good work still, or like at the very least, like, you know, I think to me, Heather Cox Richardson feels like something apart, like where she's like even like the most sort of like willfully ignorant, or like it's just, or like essentially at this point, I consider her like a partisan hack. Like it's sort of like the line between serious scholar and partisan hack, I think, is like kind of fully blurred. But I think that like, I guess the way that I think about it, or what I've been thinking a lot about in terms of this this piece, has been like, it's really about like the types of decisions that people make about emphasis. And a lot of what I think I take issue with is like not so much, although this is certainly part of it, like a kind of active portrayal of the way things are. Like I think, I do think that is part of the problem, but I think in many ways it's also about sort of like what's omitted. To me, that is, it's a decision that people make perhaps for various reasons, right? Like whether it's like legibility to like mainstream media, whether it's like desire to not rock the boat. I mean, like, you know, there's so many like personal and political reasons that people do that. But to me, I just think like it's not, it doesn't, it's not certainly why, not why I became a historian. I think it's like, it's a bit like intellectually dishonest and also like politically irresponsible, right? And I think sometimes people want to say, well, like I'm speaking to X audience and so I have to do X, Y, and Z. But I just think like as historians who are like committed to doing rigorous and politically principled work, we should sort of like reject that, or at least be using, if we do have access to these types of like whatever more like liberal mainstream spaces, like we should always be using that to kind of inject a fuller picture. So, and I think for me, I just to emphasize to you, like, I think like it's really like the omission that I think is so dangerous, because it's one thing to say like, oh, the US stands for X, maybe people can push back, or, but it's like, it's another thing to actually just sort of like provide a completely incomplete picture. Like it's like in the piece I talk about, you know, like fights over desegregation and how Heather Cox Richardson is like, but just putting this on the backs of, you know, like white supremacist politicians and, you know, like, or, and like the sort of like white mob being branded as sort of like a conservative reactionary group of people, when in fact, right, like we know, right, that it's like liberals were just as complicit and supportive of like anti-busing or like other forms of sort of like anti-racial integration policies. So that omission, I think, is really problematic and concerning.
Where do you think that omission comes from? Because one of the criticisms that has been leveled is that I don't know to the degree to which this is true. Does it? Do you make money appearing on a Rachel Maddow show? Probably not for your appearance, but in theory for building your audience, right? So what? Why were those omissions made? I'm going to assume it's not ignorance, because I think it would be very difficult to be ignorant. So what do you think is going on? Is there a cozy relationship between MSNBC and the resistance historians? It seems like they're operating in similar ideological waters, but I haven't investigated at length. So what explains the omissions? And then maybe we could talk about these larger institutional connections.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know, it's a tricky question, or like maybe not so tricky. I mean, I think there's a level in which, like, especially someone like Heather Cox Richardson, I mean, it's like hard to deny that she's making bank off of this. I mean, there's no official, like Substack doesn't release it, like its official numbers, I guess, for what people make, but it's estimated she makes like $1 million at least from just the Substack alone. So if you consider that on top of like book deals, media appearances, like that starts to rack up. So I think like for sure there's sort of like a transparent kind of like financial connection. There's also the connection, I think, in the, as we've seen during the Biden administration, like just access to the halls of power, like the ability to go visit with Biden, to have interviews with him. I mean, like that is the type of stuff that even if you're not getting paid for it, you're kind of getting that prestige, which then ultimately like will lead right to ways to
it is so funny. It's just what I think is prestigious is obviously such a disconnect about what anyone in the actual, like I would, that to me, especially at this point, who the hell would want to meet with Biden after Gaza? I mean, like, come on, why the hell would you want to do that? But I mean, the incentive structures of the collapsing historical profession were not ones I ever took too much interest in, to be honest, as my own career demonstrates.
Yeah, totally. But I was going to say, but I also think like, I don't know. I mean, it's also sort of like there are times where I read Heather Cox Richardson's, both her like her books and then also her Substack, where like I really do think she just like is a true believer. So I think it's also just like there's on some level, I think it's just like people who, as you mentioned, or like as you brought up, right, have only interacted with like ideas about politics through the academy. And even as we can say, there's lots of stuff in the academy that would refute a lot of what she's talking about. I think it's like, it's just like, it comes from like this deep ideological belief in like the inherent goodness of this project that one can only really have when you're like a part of a class that benefits from it, right? Or that like is ultimately rewarded as part of the structure.
What is your sense, rather, of how the historians who are not resistance historians relate to them? So my sense, and I'll just, my honest sense is that there was always a sniff of ridiculousness about it, I think, from the beginning. I think many historians thought it, you know, it's good insofar as to get, you know, criticize the 1776 project or correct, you know, a virulent racist like Dinesh D'Souza's, bastardizing of American history that's so far so good, but it seemed pretty quickly to spiral into this this now mocked historian here thing. Yeah. And that as particularly as Biden prosecuted Gaza, and then once Trump won again, now it seems like now are the gloves are off, right? Charlotte, correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think you would have written this 3 years ago even, but now it does seem like more available, or correct me if I'm wrong. So no, how do you think historians relate to it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's interesting. I think I think that it's changed the way I would have written it. Like, I think back then it felt sort of more of like almost just a frustration with the kind of, I don't know, the sort of self-promotion of it. Like, to me, I just felt like it was so sort of like ultimately self-serving to be like, let me dunk on this person and like get all these likes and retweets. And I just, like, to me, it felt like, and I think I was frustrated by the perception that it was a form of organizing or like a form of resistance, like fighting back. I was like, no, like posting is not, and I say this as a prodigious poster, but like posting is not organizing. Posting is not like political change, right? And I think that, you know, if historians really want to be a part of something, it's like, okay, well, like organize a union, right? Or like, or like organize, you know, to protect your colleagues who are being censored or pushed out because they, you know, have expressed support for Palestinian rights, right? Like, they like things like that. So I think back then it was more of just like a bit of the like reaction to the cringe of it, to the kind of self promo aspect. But now I think it's become even more clear. Like, this was always a part of it, but it's become even more obvious, the kind of contradiction of the project, and the way that it like refuses to actually look at the like inherent violence, or at least a compatibility of fascism with liberal democracy. So I guess, yeah, that's sort of like one way I would think about sort of why now. I forget the second part of your question.
How do you think historians have changed perfect. Their relation over time? Yeah. And I just, the way that I would phrase it, we don't have to get into this debate, is that liberal modernity shares features with fascist regimes as many modern regimes do. It's the way that, and frankly, and I just want to take this time, not to you, Charlotte, but to the audience. Oh, yes, right. I have read the Black Radical Tradition. I believe that is what they are saying. That is what they are saying. They're not saying that the United States is fascist. They are saying that liberal modernity shares features with fascism, and that should make you reconceive liberal modernity. Sorry, but the question that we should get to is this notion of historians' relations over time and how that might reveal things in the profession.
Totally. And I think, you know, we should take all these things with a certain grain of salt, given that what I'm about to cite is sort of like a New Yorker journalist who went to the AHA, I think in like 2021 or something, and was sort of, or maybe even before the pandemic, don't quote me on that, but like was sort of picking up on the vibes of the kind of Twitter historian phenomena. And it seemed like, at least of the people that she talked to, right, there was like some sense of like, oh, this is so politically invigorating, or this is so important on some level, or cool, right, that like historians are, because I do think there is a way in which like historians, except for maybe like a select few who were like part of this kind of, like the Sean Wilentzes, like who were sort of like in the mix of politics and kind of wriggled their way into the public kind of conversation. Before the Twitter historian thing, it was like a little bit like gauche, or like not very recommended, I guess, to sort of like be that public and that kind of like cheeky with people like in this way. So I think there was maybe a bit of an excitement about that, a sense that like this was maybe one way historians could be a part of pushing back against, you know, the Trump regime. But I think now, that's why I kind of end the piece by thinking about the vote at the AHA. And to me, that felt like this sort of at least an indication, right, that whether or not this was like a direct, I wouldn't say it was like a direct referendum on resistance history, but it felt like in spirit, there's in the grassroots among historians, right, like there's a rejection of these kind of carve outs that the kind of like resistance, liberalism, resistance historian kind of camp want to sustain. And of course, you know, with the AHA blocking that resolution against Scholasticide in Gaza, we maybe see like in the attempt of the sort of institution to wrangle that back, or to kind of like go back to the sort of safe place, right, of like playing along with the liberals and despite the contradictions. But I guess I feel like among the grassroots, there's more of a sense of like this is incomplete. Like, even if I was supportive, maybe of the kind of initial dunking, like, this is incomplete, this is incoherent. And if this can't really like move with, you know, the actual events on the ground, then like it's essentially useless and essentially just a form of like partisan shilling or stenography.
Well, and self-promotion, right? I mean, this is the thing that I think people found distasteful, is that there was an intense self-promotion, or it appeared to be an intense self-promotion effort. And Derek, I'll get to you, just, I just want to make one very quick point. Yeah. I think there was also a problem with this, the theory of politics, was the idea that you're going to then persuade people through posting and then what? And I think this was actually a problem in modern liberalism itself. But Derek, please.
Yeah.
Well, it seems very much like, you know, Barack Obama inviting the New York Times columnist to the White House, or inviting David Brooks specifically to the White House to, you know, try and sell him on the agenda, right? So nobody reads newspaper columns anymore. Nobody reads newspapers anymore. But these guys, the resistance historians, got themselves a following during the first Trump administration. And so Joe Biden comes into office and he invites them all up to the White House. Come and sit with me in the Oval Office and let's talk about how you can be part of the team. And it's all a sales pitch, right? It's like flattering these folks, flattering their egos. The president of the United States has asked me to serve my country by leading the poor, ignorant Americans to the light of whatever truth I'm bringing to them. And it's got to be very flattering to the ego. It's got to make you feel really important and like you really want to push for this guy. But it's the same phenomenon, right? It's just schmoozing a columnist effectively. Yeah. The difference being, like, David Brooks is a hack. David Brooks knows he's a hack at the end of the day. Like, everybody knows David Brooks is a hack, including him. These people purport to be truth tellers, in a sense, or they purport to be teachers who deal in facts about American history, and yet they've allowed themselves again to be sucked into this world where they're co-opted by a political party and a particular administration to deliver the same kind of hackneyed messaging that you get out of a newspaper columnist.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this was especially visible when Heather Cox Richardson was sort of deputized. I mean, I don't know if she was officially deputized, but at the very least, she self-deputized herself, I think, appearing on, I think it was CNN, Christina Lepore's show, I'm pretty sure. But like, to sort of, after Biden's horrific debate with Trump, to sort of like come out and say, actually, no, like Biden can still do it. He's the only candidate. And of course, you know, once that fell apart, she quickly got in line with Kamala Harris, but, you know, like a good like a good party, you know, like, hack.
I mean, she put on her historian hat and said, never in American history has a president quitting the race at this time worked out for his party. It's happened, what, like once? Like, what are you talking about? What are you doing?
Just totally absurd. And but I want to say too, like, I mean, because I think I share with both of you a sort of like disgust at the grift of it all. Like, there's just something so kind of repellent about that, and gross, and it's like fun to, you know, sort of shit on that, essentially. But I think, like, for me, what is like just as, if not more, concerning is like, and it's not to say the grift doesn't matter, because it does, but it's like, to me, it's that like they genuinely have platforms that are, you know, infecting or like directing the minds of people that I think, you know, certainly some liberals are just like, they're bought into the project and they're like gonna just sit there and defend capitalism and private property, like, and imperialism to the end of their day. But I think there are a lot of people who after 2016 were like rightfully like freaked out by Trump, upset by Trump, who like have a belief in like basic human dignity, in equality, in, you know, and like, but who maybe are sort of like politically not very well educated. They're not a part of any kind of left project. They're sort of just like floating in a kind of like nimble or malleable middle, but who, like, when they see someone, you know, when they engage with this type of kind of pop historiography and see it as sort of like some kind of a guide for how to act or how to think, right? Like, that actually is limiting their political imagination and like hindering, you know, a project or like their potential sort of conscription into a project that is more radical, and that would have more potential to actually upend the very like fascistic ideologies that they like very correctly and genuinely want to fight. So I think for me, it's like just as problematic. It's not, I mean, whatever, they make their money. That doesn't shock me per se, but it's like also just a sort of like mass miseducation that I think occurs under the kind of banner of like their prestige and presumed objectivity, right? As historians, as experts in the field. So that is, I think, what I find like really egregious and dangerous as well.
Do we know any of the demographics? I mean, I imagine Cox Richardson appeals primarily to wealthier older women, but I'm not sure if that's accurate. But do we know?
No, yeah. So again, I think because Substack is sort of cagey on demographics, or like on their data, I mean, I don't know if we know for sure. I remember from one of the New York Times articles, I believe they reference that it's like largely, yeah, like middle-aged white women. I assume probably like across a broad middle class. But, you know, like I'll speak personally, like, you know, my mom bought her book and she's a part of that demographic. And, you know, and it's one of these things where like, I think, you know, I have talked to my mom about a lot of issues. I think that she's moved left, you know, over my time kind of talking to her. And yet, right, like this kind of project at like, or in this sort of framing appeals to her, or at the very least, like kind of can capture her imagination. And I just, and it just like, it makes me feel like there's so many other people who like, if this is their political education, they're going to just, they're not only going to feel like sort of immense despair. Like, I think that's another, you know, it's sort of part of this too, that it's like, if you're just in a state of like panic, right? Like 24/7, you're not really able to like think very like critically or thoughtfully about what to do next. But it's like, then they're also just getting the message that like, all right, essentially you just have to like vote harder, or, you know, like keep giving money to the Democratic Party. And, you know, I think eventually maybe that'll wear out. And I think increasingly people are realizing how sort of like there's, that's not really paying out in the end. But I think for many people, that's what they're hearing, right? That like, this is, that at the end of the day, like Democrats are an opposition party that will defeat fascism, even despite the fact that they're like, you know, that Kamala Harris was saying she wanted to have one in her in her cabinet, right? Like, whatever. But like, you know, I just think that's like such a profound limitation on like the political education of a large segment of Americans, right? So yeah.
Check engine light on. Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the specific ideas that you investigate in the article. For example, this notion of party polarization and others. What are some of the actual ideas being promoted by the resistance historians that you think either do not emerge from the literature, or do not make much sense in terms of larger sweeps of history, wherever you want to take this? But I know party polarization is a big one, and then we could maybe go from there.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I think I pull an example from her, like her Substack, where she kind of talks about, you know, the history of segregation, and very much kind of, you know, frames it as like, you know, Brown v. Board, this transformative civil rights decision, landmark decision, right? But that it sparked a backlash where the Southern segregationist legislatures, as well as kind of like white Southern grassroots white supremacists, you know, fought this tooth and nail. They, you know, found ways to funnel tax money to private segregation academies, not to mention just like literal violence against, you know, Black students trying to integrate schools. And so, of course, there is like, there's truth to that, right? Like, I'm not here to say that that's the wrong history entirely, right? Like that is true. That did happen. And it's a worthy, like, it's something to interrogate. It's something to analyze and situate as a part of our broader analysis of American politics and sort of like how state power operates. But of course, like, it then like very much overlooks or omits or is like a partial history of segregation and like that, you know, overlooks a sort of like significant bipartisan investment in beating back some of the most like aggressive and bold attempts at desegregation. In fact, right, like Biden himself in the 70s was one of the like a key figure in trying to like find ways at the federal level to weaken and prevent desegregation. And that came out of like his work, you know, his like experience with constituents in Delaware who were upset about like an attempt to desegregate through busing. So it's like once we, like, what does it mean, right, to integrate that into our analysis? It kind of fundamentally changes like who we think our targets are, how we think about the Democratic Party, how we think about liberalism, right? And also requires, you know, I just think it completely changes our conception of politics. But the liberal historians, right, like, or the resistance historians, like they want to keep it focused on Republicans, on this reactionary politics that I think she also wants to suggest in her project. This gets into sort of like her conception of like U.S. ideals and democracy, right? Like she wants to really frame the Republicans of today and the long and the kind of their long lineage, right, as something like aberrant or the something that is, you know, was not intended to hold up or have a place, right, like at, within the U.S.'s like founding principles, which of course is like total BS. And of course, like many people, I mean, it's like there's too many to list, right? I've like, you know, talked about how like these founding principles of like natural rights or equality of man, like the social contract, like, these were, you know, very much built upon like non-white racial exclusion.
And everyone knows this, right? This isn't like, it's not 1943. Controversial. Yeah. This was known by like 1962 100%. And had become almost mainstream. So what is this omission? Wild. It's weird.
This is history for the, I want to go back to brunch crowd, right? I mean, isn't that what it is at the end of the day? Like it's, America is on autopilot. It's been on autopilot since the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah.
And we're just on this steady course toward freedom and equality and perfection for everyone in a utopia. If only it weren't for those darn mean old Republicans and Donald Trump who came around and got in the way. And if we can just get rid of them, everything can go back on autopilot and you don't have to worry about it. And it eludes or elides like all the work that had to be done to achieve like any progress over the course of American history. It's just like it's all baked into the cake already. And you just have to go have your brunch and not worry about it. And, you know, if we get rid of these bad guys, then everything will be fine again.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also the thing that I kind of talked about briefly too, that I also find really egregious as someone who sort of like has studied radical social movements is a sort of like claim that, you know, African-Americans or women have appealed to these principles, right? So they must be virtuous. And it's like, right. Well, so like political strategy, right, sometimes requires people to sort of like appeal or like, you know, you can understand why at various points in history appealing to these principles might have been like a political strategy or tactic. And in fact, there were many debates right at the time, like doesn't matter what movement you pick, but about whether or not that was actually the best tactic or like whether or not that action was undermining like actual goals of liberation.
I just have to do a quick tangent. I think something similar happens today with fascism, where people refer to the quote unquote black radical tradition to be like, oh, well, how dare you? That's happened to me. And look, Stuart Hall disagrees, you know, Stuart Hall I is on my side. And I just think that is something that happens consistently in American politics because there's a Puritan obsession here with sort of like purity. And it's very uncomfortable and racialized, I think, in a very dark, dangerous way. And I think it actually goes across the liberal and left political spectrum. So I just wanted to highlight that.
Yeah. And I think also just getting back to this point around sort of like why, you know, sort of like we all know this is bullshit. So why is it so, why is she still like receiving such a platform? Why, or like sort of what purpose is it serving? I think at the end of the day, it's sort of like as simple as essentially like a desire. It's like, it's the type of history that like protects and rehabilitates like capitalism, right? Like, you know, it's essentially like it allows for at the end of the day, like the structures to stay in place, right? For the prisons to stay open, right? I pulled out when I was prepping for this, just, I feel like you guys will like this. I pulled out, I was just kind of glancing at her most recent writing on her Substack. And so here's just kind of an example, I think, of like a way that the product is like preservative in the most kind of ridiculous way. So she says, this is from just yesterday, Trump appears to be trying to gain control over the military and turn it into a political instrument. Already like an absurd claim to act like the military is not one, but okay.
Oh my God. No, yeah. No.
This is like when Hassan went on the Pod Save podcast and he's like, the Democrats should use the state against their political enemies. And I forget who was. He's like, oh my, they were like aghast.
They're like, wait,
it's
what?
Like, oh my God. Oh my God. How dare you? It's a good thing that's never happened. Oh my God.
But she continues. So she says, in his inaugural address, this is Trump, he said he would free the U.S. military, quote, to focus on their sole mission, defeating America's enemies. But in fact, the stated mission of the U.S. military is, quote, to deter war and ensure our nation's security. These two statements are not the same thing. And it's like, just like totally absurd. Like, you know, this kind of like willfully taking the mission of the U.S. military at face value. Also to pretend that like, I mean, to pretend that the U.S. is like interested in deterring war is just like actually laughable. But then even this, the idea that like ensuring our nation's security and defeating America's enemies are somehow different, or like different projects, how like one is honorable, the other is evil and imperialist. It's like this can't be read as anything other than like an attempt to like rehabilitate and protect and preserve like American imperialism and capitalism, rather than, you know, just even though, right, like as many people know, those very ideologies and the institutions they spawn are in fact what give rise to like, you know, American fascism and fascistic politics.
So why do you think, well, first of all, has Richardson or Cruz commented on Gaza? I believe Cruz has, but it took a while, or am I misunderstanding?
Yeah. So as far as I know, Heather Cox Richardson's only commentary has been to like do interviews with Anthony Blinken. So I think, you know, her kind, like, I think even if you look at her Substack, it's like the standard kind of, like Biden's box and ADL style framing of like, you know, like there was like, I remember looking at the campus protest stuff and it was like sort of not a ton, but what was there was sort of like already a bit shady, if that makes sense, or kind of like, you know, suggesting that they're at minimum misguided. Cruz, I think, like, you know, he did eventually, after being bullied by Tim Barker, you know, come out and say,
right, Tim, yeah, was, yeah, Tim, Tim,
he, like, vicious bullying.
Great follow on Twitter. Everyone follow Tim. He's he's an excellent scholar of military Keynesianism. Totally, his dissertation is just excellent.
Yes, no, definitely. But like, you know, so he did eventually say, like, oh, I'm happy this vote. I forget whether it was happy the vote's happening or happy that they voted in the way that they did. Either way, it's like, sure, that counts as something. And I think, like, if I recall, he's maybe like retweeted a thing here or there. But then at the same time, like, how then do you explain, or I find it to be irresponsible, at least, to then have, you know, on your Substack, where he was at the DNC and kind of doing these like short little recaps, to make, you know, no mention of Gaza, no mention of the uncommitted's protest, of the DNC's refusal to give them even like, again, the sort of like bare minimum platform to not even say like the most, you know, radical stuff, right? To basically say like, you know, also Palestinians are being murdered and this is like horrific and something that the Democratic Party should be fighting against. And then on top of that, just like, you know, like in general, there was just no critique. It was like, oh, the party is so invigorated and like Biden's, you know, there's a sense of like labor's in the house or whatever, like all like just like this very positive stuff. And so to me, I'm like, I don't know what he personally thinks. I get the sense that he probably has a more sophisticated and possibly even like left-leaning opinion than he has put out there. But I think that like we also have to read these decisions to speak or not to speak as indicative of something. And as like, you know, whether or not whatever he personally feels, like these decisions ultimately like uphold a status quo that is violent. And that's something that I think we all, like as scholars, as commentators, whatever, like we should be accountable to that.
I want to take a step back and do some original reporting of my own right now. I'm just curious, how do younger historians view the profession? I'm probably a generation of historian above you. I got my PhD in 2013. but there was still, you know, hegemony in the history. There was still this notion that, like, if you keep your head down, maybe you too could get to Harvard one day, even if there was, you know, that recognition that things were coming off the wheels a little bit after 2008. There was still, I would say, like, the average history grad student bought in to some degree. And I'm just curious how that has changed or how that has not changed. And I'd like to use that as an intro to talk about what I see as a larger crisis of the historical profession.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, I'm not sure I have too much that's profound to say other than just, I think that it feels sort of bleak. I mean, I like speaking for myself, I think I felt like the kind of promise that perhaps was once there, where like if you sort of play along or kind of float under the radar a little bit, you will get X job and then maybe you can expand or you can kind of be more your true self or something like that. That kind of trajectory to me just like it feels increasingly it was always like a kind of like cheap in some ways, or like we could critique that as kind of the framework, but it also just felt like increasingly sort of completely not worth my time given how bad the job market is. And also given, I think, just also surveying the kind of like post 2020 and then also post like campus protests kind of landscape. It's like, why would I want to be in, you know, at these institutions, underpaid, overworked, like likely, and like, unless you land something really cushy, which again is like one in a million, you know, like why would I want to subject myself to this place? So I guess I feel like, you know, I still have friends that are on the job market that are, you know, doing amazing work.
Some of your best friends are on the job market.
Yeah, exactly. Some of my best friends, and everyone should hire them. They're all amazing. But yeah, like, I guess it feels increasingly sort of bleak. And I guess, yeah, like for me, and like, again, this is maybe idiosyncratic, but like, I think I just sort of was like, I'm already doing writing, public writing. No, it will never sustain me as a career. I'm well aware of that. I will always have a day job. But it's like, for me, it felt more meaningful to like write about what I actually wanted to write about in the way I wanted to write it, like write about it, to pursue it kind of outside of the academy.
Yeah, especially because, yeah. I mean, the odds are just terrible.
Odds are awful.
They're almost non-existent at this point. So yeah. I do. It is good when younger scholars don't censor themselves. And I kind of also want to talk about the American Historical Association, because to me, it really does seem like the historical profession is in crisis. Myself and friend of the show, Mike Brennis, wrote an article in 2018 or 2019, given the title by the Chronicle, A Moral Stain on the Profession.
I remember when that came out. It was like, you know.
Yeah, it was like a bomb. But it was basically just made the argument that like alt-ac is not actually a solution to your profession dying. And then the AHA responded with, we're not a union, so good luck. But I was just wondering, like, where do you see the sort of AHA, the scholasticide veto, the profession as a whole? I mean, as probably everyone listened, I'm pretty sure it's doomed. And I think you actually see this amongst scholars of my generation who are like thinking of that second book. It's like, are we really going to spend 8 years in an archive for literally no one to read it? Because graduate students are actually crucial to the revitalization of the entire project. And if the thing has no future, then what are you doing? And I actually do think, then I'll stop talking, that the move to the public by Cruz and Richardson makes a lot of sense, not just technologically, but like, why write that third or fourth book at this point, right? There's literally almost no one to read it. So why not engage? And I myself and impelled by that in certain regards. So I'm just curious what you think about the AHA, the profession, the future or lack thereof.
I mean, I think, you know, there's a part of me that like wants to resist the proclamation that it's doomed. And I say that only because I think I want to believe in like the capacity of people to organize. And I think, you know, for academics that are listening to this, grad students, like you should be, you know, organizing and like trying to fight to I think I get frustrated too when people talk about like, oh, it's good to reduce the number of admissions because there's no jobs. And I'm like, okay, but like that, like, no, because also like, I mean, like, yes, I understand that, but also
it's capitulation to the market, it's right? It's just saying like, we're not going to do anything, and it's basically,
also, like, right? Hastening the decline of, like, I think, like, we all at the end of the day do believe, right, that sort of like humanistic inquiry and like, and the study of history, the study of the past, right, like, has a purpose and is something that we need more and more people to be doing at like a rigorous, sophisticated level. So I think it's just like, I'm fearful in the same way you are. I think that like the structures are not set up, right? Like both in terms of the AHA and it's kind of like completely weak and or non-existent like response, other than just to say like, here's a webinar on alt hackers or whatever they do. I don't really even know what they do, but that's what I assume they do. Or just at the level of like our departments, our universities, like who are just not thinking on the scale or at the level. I mean, maybe this, I don't know, like it'll be interesting. I won't get my hopes up, but I think it's interesting with the federal aid freeze stuff, like how that, and actually in a funny, it's like sort of like an ironic way that affects STEM more than more than humanity. So I guess
way like, more. It's so funny. They don't like, get that. Yeah,
Marxists and like chemistry departments, I guess, but
they're leaving them alone. They're leaving the humanities like, alone with these freezes. It's so funny.
Yeah. So I'm like, I don't know if like that will shift like anything at all, like in kind of higher ed policymaking or anything like that. Probably not, but it's an interesting kind of shift, I guess, in the kind of state of play. But yeah, I think it's very bleak, but I think that like, I guess, and I don't know, I also agree with you about the sort of like, what is the purpose of doing, or like the sort of turn to the public as being maybe a kind of reaction to the decline of the academy. I want to be clear that like, I do think that like public engagement is good. I know you guys think that too, but just like, I think it's definitely not, yeah, the actual like turn to the public that I think is bad. It's like the method of doing it. And I think that like, I don't know, I guess I'm sort of like, I want there to be public facing scholarship that's rigorous, that's principled. And I think that I have no issue with academics doing that alongside, you know, like their other academic work so long, right, as it's like not just complete liberal apologia drivel. So yeah.
So I, while we're on the subject of the AHA, yeah, and you end your piece talking about the vote and the veto of the scholasticide measure and the explanations for the veto from the board were basically looked like, from my perspective, they went down two channels. One was, well, we don't know what's happening in Gaza, which is so absurd I can't even begin to formulate an answer. Like, they destroyed all the colleges and schools. Like, we know that they did that. We know that the Israelis did that. Like, that's a fact. All of that is destroyed.
Yeah.
But okay, fine. That's silly. But the other one was, you know, heaven forfend that the American Historical Association would take a political stance on something. What are you, crazy? We're just historians. And it, at the time, the criticism of that was, well, you guys did adopt a resolution on Ukraine, like when Russia invaded Ukraine. But since then, and this is what I want to ask about, Jim Grossman, the director of the AHA, did a whole little editorial bit this week slamming the Trump administration for distorting history. And like, what are you doing as an organization? Are you political or are you not political? Or is it just like, we flow where the water will, you know, where the river takes us. And if it's safe to say something about Donald Trump, or if we feel it's safe to say something about Ukraine, that's great. But when it's Gaza, there's some resistance there. Resistance, that's a good word. You know, there's some, you know, we get some pushback from that. Let's not touch that. It feels like that's really the defining characteristic.
Yeah.
Danny, yeah. I was curious your take on Grossman's thing too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just obvious hypocrisy. And the issue is that liberalism doesn't have the hegemony it did to paper over those contradictions like it did in the past. And I think that's really what's happening when we're talking about resistance historians, whether we're talking about the Democratic Party or whether we're talking about the American Historical Association. These are groups and institutions of liberalism, and this ideology, no one actually believes in it any longer. But again, Fukuyama was right, and there's been no actually challenging ideology. So this is one reason everyone feels fucking insane, because there's absolutely absolutely no guiding light. I'm beginning to believe that the 20th century was a peculiarly ideological century, and that the 21st century is actually not going to be as ideological. Partially, I think that's because capitalism is quote unquote won, that there is essentially no resistance to capitalism. I know some of my friends on the left disagree about China. I think that whatever China is, it's certainly not the American form of capitalism, but I would say it's a form of statist or state capitalism. So there's no where to really go ideologically. So in a system that basically denies ordinary people any way, shape, or form in changing things, so politics winds up being all discourse, you wind up just going in these ridiculous circles. Like right now, I'm sure this will be forgotten by the time this episode airs. Everyone on Twitter is talking about this New York Magazine cover, and frankly, who gives a shit? You know, this is not politics, whatever it is of the young conservatives, whatever it is, it's not politics. So we have this moment where, as Anton said, this hyper-political moment, and as I said, when there's no mass politics any longer, and then everyone feels fucking nuts, and then liberalism is not hegemonic. So that's my take. But Charlotte,
no, please. I mean, I think, you know, I'm just thinking a lot about sort of like, yeah, it's sort of just such a like absurd attempt to sort of get historians of all people, right? Like you have to know your membership is not like your membership is informed, right? But it's like, this is like really ridiculous attempt to sort of get people to like not see what's in front of their eyes, which I think is just like, has always been the case. Like, I think, you know, lest we forget, attempts, you know, to kind of get the AHA to make a statement on the Vietnam War that were like, you know, really aggressively fought by radical historians at the time.
But at least back then, they weren't making statements all the time.
Yeah.
The AHA in the 50s and the 60s making statements on anything.
Exactly.
So I actually think that, yeah, like, that's a little bit of a different... I agree. Like, clearly you go against the Vietnam War, but the context is a little different. AHA makes statements every 3 seconds these
totally,
days.
Totally. No, it's like, it's a very different context. Like, it's just to say that I think, like, historians have, or at least, like, in the grassroots, right, have sort of, like, been eager to call out this hypocrisy or the kind of like
absolutely
total bullshit of what it means to be like ideologically nonpartisan or something like that. But it's, as you've said, like it's even more absurd given the types of statements that they have been making. And I guess, yeah, I think it's like the thing that I worry most about, or that I feel most like depressed about, is just this like general sense of like, I don't know, it feels like at every corner, and the war, or like the US's support for Israel and for the genocide in Gaza, feels like the kind of like a mass like breaking point on this, where it's like everywhere you turn, like nothing works to actually change these people. Like, which again, like I'm not necessarily shocked by, I wasn't born yesterday, but it feels sort of like, okay, so like mass protests in the streets, the campus encampments, endless amounts of sort of other attempts at pressure, you know, the AHA being just kind of like a small one, right? And one that actually was like, you could argue was strategically, and I don't mean this as a critique of the organizers, but like strategically did not frame itself as a BDS resolution, right? Like strategically, it was like, we're not wading into the BDS stuff. It's kind of like a hot potato, unfortunately, still for, you know, for like these liberal institutions, but we just are asking for like a recognition and an opposition to this like horrific, you know, like visible like horror in Gaza, as you know, specifically surrounding educational institutions and scholars and the access to education, right? And like, yeah, they can't even do that. And I think like that is something that feels like this sort of like mass depression of like our ability to actually change these organizations. Not that we should fetishize wanting to change them, but it just feels like further, like it's like, it just, I feel like we're just completely given constant confirmation of like how little they give a fuck about, you know, even like mass discontent. And you could apply that to like the economy or like other, you know, kind of other segments as well. Yeah.
Right. And this is just to end, I think this is really the ultimate reason that liberalism as an ideology is in crisis, probably for sociological material reasons. It's unable to incorporate a critique. And that has been the power of American liberalism, the ability to actually transform it. As Gary Gersel wrote in that famous, I think from 1994 essay, it's protean, right? This is what makes it like really powerful and allowed it to be hegemonic. It's just been incapable of doing that for the last two decades in a very, very strange way. way when they, I mean, really, Obama was given an opportunity to like reshape liberalism in a way that would actually take account of the contradictions of a tech-based financialized capitalism. Instead, he just said, no, here's money, destroy more industries. I think it's why it's in crisis. And the sad thing is that nothing is really coming to replace it. And as people probably know, this is why I'm not overly concerned in the medium term with the far right, because I also don't think it really has juice. I don't think that they're actually speaking to real material concerns of constituencies. And I think the Trump executive orders demonstrate that. Like, it's so obviously not in the interest of the base that he has constructed. It's just that he himself is a personally charismatic figure that is able to rally people around him, primarily because he's an anti-systemic thinker, anti-systemic politician, not thinker, the way he approaches things. So I think that is the moment we're in of dislocation, and no one knows even what to align with, as opposed to to say nothing of what tactics to adopt. So before we go, Charlotte, do you have any final thoughts? Anything you want to leave listeners with?
Good question. I guess nothing extremely profound other than just to say that, like, I think the thing that makes me very upset about this is just that, like, the way that this type of bunk history is essentially like being fed to masses of people and is limiting our political imaginations. And so this is just sort of like maybe a broader call for historians who are principled to, like, you know, like, be as loud, to like drown out this shit, to not entertain it. I think to your point, Dan, it's like, you know, with the kind of decline of history as a profession, maybe they'll become even more irrelevant, which is like, maybe we can use that, right? Like, I already think in some ways their relevancy is getting strange in the current moment of Trump.
It's I think historians now consider it embarrassing. And so that's a big social change.
Yes.
That was not true even 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I think post-Gaza, post-Trump second victory, it's like kind of, it's got a bad odor to it.
Yeah.
That it didn't necessarily, that's my sense, anecdotal, admittedly.
Yeah.
That's my anecdotal sense. So I think that is where we're headed.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. So I think we can leave it at that. Nothing too profound to add, but thank
you. Cool. Well,
So
I'm gonna push everyone to go check out the piece, The End of Resistance History. Charlotte, thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back again soon.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to meet you both.
Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com. Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.